This episode series was done in partnership with and sponsored by Showtime.
Inspector General Catherine Leahy Scott spent hours here at the Clinton County Jail interviewing Joyce Mitchell. As part of Mitchell's plea deal, she was ordered to cooperate with investigators with releasing details about the prison escape of Richard Matt and David Sweat.
You ever hear talk of prison breaks when you were there?
Never.
Never. It was just so impossible that it wasn't even something that was more or less discussed behind the walls there.
No. Guys is not going to talk about prison breaks. If it's somebody that actually is going to, you know, consider doing something like that, they're going to keep that to themselves because you have other guys in there that would actually tell, you know, the administration what's going on to try to maybe cut daytime. So that's not something that you're going to hear people talk about.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today on the same side of the pond is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and I'm very happy to be on this side of the pond.
Great.
We're happy to have you back, Laura. I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the minds that bring those crimes to justice.
Well, great. And as we all know, we're all really excited today because we have two incredibly special guests.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me. I'm Catherine Leahy Scott. I'm the New York State Inspector General. And with me is my Deputy Inspector General,
James Davis. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming, Catherine and James. I am so happy to welcome you, as are Lisa and Laura. And we want to talk about an incredibly well-written, amazing report about an escape from Dannemora. Can you tell us when you started writing that report?
Sure. That was a report that deals with the escape of two inmates from the Clinton Correctional Facility, which is located in upstate New York, Dannemora, New York. And the escape occurred in the late hours of June 5th, 2015, into the early morning hours of June 6th, 2015. We had conducted almost a year-long investigation into that matter, and the report was actually issued and published a year later on the anniversary date, June 6th of 2016. We actually started writing that report, I would say sometime in the fall and early winter 2015-2016, as that's when the evidence was really coming together for us to actually start putting pen to paper to write the report.
So could we step back for just 1 second? So what were you doing on the morning of June 6th, 2015?
Absolutely. And thank you for the question, because it is a day that in your career that you don't forget certain days. And that's one of the days I will never forget. I recall that it was a Saturday morning. I was outside working around my home with my husband. And we have a little pool house off the side of our pool where there is a TV set there. We have our morning coffee. It was, you know, a beautiful spring, early summer day, and my husband and I were having coffee, and we had the news on, and the breaking news was that two inmates from the Clinton Correctional Facility had escaped. I knew immediately at that moment, as I had jurisdiction over the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, that I was going to be involved in that matter. So the first time I actually heard about it was through the news. And I think almost instantaneously, my phones were going off. So again, it's a time that you'd never forget. In response to listening to the news and then receiving the information, I immediately called my executive staff. And of course, one of the folks I called was Jim, because my office is divided toward territories around the state of New York. And Jim is in charge of my upstate regional office and area, which covers the North Country. So my conversation along the lines with Jim was, Jim, do you know where generally Dannemora and Plattsburgh is? Have you seen the news? So Jim had immediately made himself aware of certain situations.
And so. I grew up in upstate, and I realized I was heading to Little Siberia.
Right.
Well, just so our listeners know, She's not talking about me, Jim Clementi. She's talking about, and we'll call him James Deputy Davis, sure, if that's okay.
Deputy Jim.
Deputy Jim.
Okay. Deputy Jim. I'm sure Jim loves James Deputy Jim better. So,
just so we can keep that clear, yeah, because I did not have anything to do with this investigation, although I was listening to it very intently because I think that's an amazing event in law enforcement history. It was a massive prison. It's a massive prison break and a massive hunt that followed. So a lot of that was just all over the news. Everybody was following it across the country at the time.
Just to contextualize it, Clinton Correctional, it's a maximum security prison for men, but is it the largest and third oldest operated by New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision?
That's correct.
It's obviously something that hit the news, and as they went missing at 5:16 a.m., what was the time frame that, so you're seeing it on the news, and obviously your minds are racing, but what's the time frame that you're talking to each other?
Early morning on Saturday, June 6th.
So around sort of, you know, have you had your morning breakfast? Or I just like to know a little bit of detail of the human part to you.
What were you doing, Deputy Davis?
Well, I was home with my family, and the IG called and explained that there was two murderers that had escaped, and that knowing our jurisdiction and that we oversee the Department of Corrections and where it was, I knew that we were going to be heading for a sustained time into the North Country. Not to assist with the actual escape, but to find out how to escape. Two murderers were able to escape from the largest maximum security prison in upstate New York.
And I knew, by the way, that our involvement was imminent, but not necessarily immediate, because the obvious concern at that juncture was the capture and apprehension of these two inmates. So in these types of cases, you know, I have to defer to my law enforcement partners, in particular, in this case, was the New York State Police, to make sure that we were not in any way interfering with anything that they needed to do in terms of gathering intelligence in order to apprehend these and capture these two inmates.
And the last escape occurred in 1912, right? So this was a kind of a historical moment, and it must have been incredible in terms of just you thinking about, well, the last escape was over 100 years ago. What does that mean for you in terms of your role and your involvement?
My concern immediately was that I, you know, outlining who my staff was, that was going to be boots on the ground, if you will, what it is that I immediately needed. But again, my involvement didn't occur until some 10 days later, which, you know, was frustrating, but certainly understandable from my perspective, that we needed to capture these two inmates first and not to in any way impede the ability for law enforcement to capture these two people. And obviously, law enforcement was very hopeful that it was going to happen every minute of every day. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that we all know that did not occur. So, you know, one day goes by, 2 days, you know, I'm on the phone saying, I've got to get into this facility. I have to get into this facility until such time. It was really the following weekend that we started mobilizing our team. The governor came out with a statement. Governor Cuomo came out with a statement on that Monday, June 15th, even though I had jurisdiction over the facility, actually requesting my involvement and I think rightfully so, not only the North Country, but this was a national and an international story as to how did this happen. And I think the governor was extremely responsive in saying, we're going to find out how this happened, even though we haven't captured these two inmates yet. So it was really on the 15th I mobilized my staff and we proceeded up to Clinton at that juncture. And that's after having a one-on-one conversation with the then superintendent of the state police, Joseph D'Amico, in which, you know, we had the collaboration between not only the superintendent's team, but my team as well, of sharing of resources and information and leads and things of that nature. So, you know, the superintendent and state police and law enforcement would be in charge of the manhunt, and I would be in charge of what happened inside the facility.
Well, that sounds like Governor Cuomo was very crucial in getting this thing rolling so that you could do your investigation in such a brief period of time. It was almost a year, but to get all this information together, to verify all those details, to conduct that complete investigation, to do it in such a short time on such a high level, that's really amazing.
I thank you for that, Jim, that comment, because I think that for folks that are not in the law enforcement field, they don't understand what it entails to conduct that type of full forensic investigation and review. It is not conducting a few interviews and then coming out with some type of report. We interviewed 174 individuals, and sometimes we've interviewed them on more than one occasion. We went through tens of thousands of documents, policies, directives, staffing and work charts. I mean, you can just imagine what it was like in terms of going not only through the documents, but lining up these types of witnesses to talk to them. And we wanted to make sure, number one, that we were accurate and got it right. And number two, most importantly, that this would never occur again in the state of New York.
Your report is just incredibly thorough. I mean, in terms of an investigation at a time of intense media scrutiny as well. And just the detail that you have in there, you know, there's various quotes from various interviews that you did, and we'll get into some of them because I know you interviewed Sweat, for example, four times. But the pictures that you also include really do give you an understanding of what happened in there. And, you know, you pull no punches. You are very clear about what went on and what went wrong. And I really, you know, I commend you for that.
Thank you. I think that what's also important, that the blame, if you will, doesn't lie strictly with the facility or any individual. When I approach this, we're looking at the larger systemic issues that occurred. So yes, it has to involve with certain officers, certain civilians, the management and supervision at the facility, but then taking it the next step forward, which is who are the supervisors over the facility? Let's look at docs in general. And then later on, we start looking at DOCS, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, as a whole, as against all 54 facilities in the state of New York. And we could talk about some of those recommendations and that we, to this day, we're still implementing throughout the state of New York.
And does the FBI assist in that investigation? This must be such a chaotic situation with so many agencies falling all over each other and how to, you know, coordinate resources. Jim Clem, I mean, does the FBI get involved in this kind of thing?
Well, they could if they're requested. I mean, obviously, if there's interstate aspects and international aspects to the investigation, the FBI would be the natural choice to go to. But I'm not sure if you guys needed that.
Right. The FBI was not involved in my investigation of Clinton Correctional Facility and DOCS. The FBI clearly was involved, as were multiple law enforcement agencies in the manhunt. We did not involve the FBI. I know that the FBI, at the direction, and the state police were really our law enforcement point of contact, if you will. But the FBI did conduct a few tests on, because there was a question initially, how did the two inmates escape from the facility and did they use power tools? Mm-hmm. And everyone really believed, in addition, that they must have had accomplices, that they must have used some type of power tools to escape from the facility. And that was really from the perspective of the state police requesting FBI's assistance in determining if power tools were utilized. Interestingly, they were not utilized.
And you did some interesting tests, and that's what I mean about the thoroughness.
Yes. Yeah. Jim, would you like to talk about that?
Well, yeah. When we arrived, I mean, everyone from U.S. Marshals to Canadian Royal Mounted Police and, you know, the state police and then Department of Corrections facility staff and sheriff's deputies were spread out all over the region. I've never seen such a massive police response to anything in my life. As we entered the village of Dannemora, we were passed by 70 state police cars at one point. And as we were up there, we assumed, like the IG said, that there was going to be a quick capture of these inmates, but it dragged on. But as you come upon the facility, it's hard to imagine. I mean, there are some photographs, obviously, in our report, but it's like a medieval fortress. It's 30-foot high walls, mm-hmm. 7 feet thick, built on bedrock, impenetrable, as you mentioned before, over 100 years since an escape. And we were given full access because we needed it and demanded it. to the facility, and we quickly learned that those 30-foot walls had kept in a lot of complacency. There was a, it was a culture of complacency based on the staff inside the facility, and that when you see these 30-foot walls, you have to imagine that power tools were used. We even suspected that initially, but we quickly learned that simple 99-cent hacksaw blades were what were used to cut out of the cells and then to cut into different areas underneath. There's an amazing complex of tunnels underneath the facility.
Right. And the reason why you thought power tools were used were because of the clean nature of the cuts and how extensive the cuts were?
Yeah. And you look at the back of the cell walls. The back of the cell walls are perfectly flat. The cells are 6 foot by 8 foot, and it's solid steel. They decided, and appropriately so ultimately, because they escaped, they decided the vent, which is on the floor behind their beds, was a good access point, and they started cutting into that area. And when we interviewed Sweat right at Albany Med, he was at the Albany Medical Center, the local hospital here in Albany in the capital, after his capture, we asked him, what made you think that you could cut out of a steel wall? And he said, everything cuts. Simple as that. Everything cuts. Oh. And he explained to us that Joyce Mitchell, the civilian tailor shop employee, had brought in blades on a number of occasions, and that he knew to cut them, bend them in half to make a sharper point. And he literally said, I dragged the blade with a single tooth across the back of my cell until it finally caught enough. And this is a thing that takes weeks, not days. And inmates have all the time in the world. And that's exactly what he utilized. So like you said before, we ultimately tried to reenact that. We bought the same exact thickness steel plate from the walls and dressed in business suits in our own office here in the state capitol. Within 4 hours, we were able to cut through the steel plate. And it was shocking even to us.
Wow.
And that's what I thought was fascinating.
But getting back to the point of why everyone thought that power tools were utilized, it's not only the precision and the cleanness of the cuts that we witnessed, but was also the impediments that they faced down in the tunnels and the labyrinths of the tunnels. And coming upon those impediments, the clean cuts that were seen breaking through pipes and breaking through the bricks and things of that nature, and that there was also strikes on the outer perimeter wall, that everyone thought that power tools were utilized, and we came to find out differently. So,
right, and it was interesting too. Everybody now knows, or at least from the report, they now know how they ultimately were able to breach the wall. But in interviews and from our investigation on the ground, that was not the original plan. The original plan was to find a sewer a sewer access that they could get outside of the walls, because obviously the sewer has to run outside of the walls of the prison, or that there would be an electrical wires that they could follow out. It was only later, as Sweat made it all the way to the outer wall, that he saw the steam pipe and thought, oh my gosh, this might be a way to get through that outer wall, which is 7 feet thick.
Once the heat went off in the facility.
You know, it definitely, when you woke up, you were definitely thinking about it, and it was pretty crazy, and it felt almost like you were in a movie. So it was pretty crazy for the 3 weeks it lasted.
So Sweat was also very thorough with the tape that he put over the cut lines and then painted over it. And you have pictures of that in your report. But also, you know, I'm sort of amazed by the fact he could navigate through those tunnels. I mean, this is without a map, and be able to get to, you know, an outside wall. It's not just sort of the steam pipes and everything else that he managed to cut through, but also being able to navigate through those tunnels.
Yeah, well, it took months, but he's in talking to him, to Sweat, he noted we had the same exact question, and he said he took a lot of time and he mapped it out in his head. He hit a lot of dead ends, but he always knew to follow the steam pipe and the electrical that was down in the basement all the way through to he knew it had to reach the outer wall, and that's what he followed.
And in addition, it was also, they would also take the information of Sweat, you know, he spent the first few weeks, if you will, trying to navigate the labyrinth of tunnels, but they would also compare it to when they were out walking to mm-hmm. the tailor shops or to their industry, wherever they were working, and compare where they were with some landmarks in the outside of the facility. And it was also remarkable when Jim and I were at the facility and we stood in the actual tailor shop, you would look out the window of the tailor shop and you would clearly see the street and the steam plant. So you knew just by standing in the tailor shop in the industry where you would have to go in order to escape from the facility.
That must have been such a tantalizing vision for those inmates to be looking out that window and see their goal every day, you know, very inspiring to them. One question I had is, how can you be conducting this investigation in this active prison? I mean, how do you lock down the evidence and make sure everything is preserved? And especially if it's a systematic problem that people aren't hiding evidence or destroying things inadvertently or on purpose.
That's true with all the investigations we conduct, quite frankly. But two things is, first is the facility itself was in lockdown, which there was no movement of the inmates in the facility for quite some time. That's the first thing. The second is docs had made available to us a standing building within the facility that my team actually took over. And we used that as a basis of operation in working in the facility. At some point, the inmates were permitted to start moving around the facility, and we operated in that kind of environment. In addition to looking in the tunnels and looking at the honor block and looking at the catwalks and things of that nature, we were in the administration office pulling every file imaginable. Immediately after the escape, it would be very difficult for someone to shred or somehow dispose of documents because it was really the law enforcement was all over and we were there 10 days later. The frustrating part about it was the amount of documents that we had to obtain and then going through those documents. And our requests started off as specific requests. And then eventually we just took everything because it was just easier for us to take everything because we did not feel we were getting information. And I don't want to necessarily attribute it to the fact that they were in some way, you know, impeding our investigation. They just didn't know what we wanted. So it was just better that we took everything. So we literally took all the administration documents at that point and went through them.
Well, I can totally relate. I was doing an independent counsel investigation at one point, and on Christmas Eve, the White House released 70,000 pages to us. And so, and they had to be reviewed in a SCIF, secured compartmentalized information facility. So it had to be done in a locked environment in the White House. So it was a very difficult investigation to do. So I could totally relate to what you went through. And I want to ask you a couple of questions. You said that it was Saturday morning. Do you think that the prisoners planned it so that it would be discovered on a Saturday morning when presumably there would be a shorter staff?
No.
No. In the interviews that we conducted, the night that Sweat first made it out was the night preceding the escape. And he was able to finally get through the steam pipe, go all the way to the power station, the steam power generator, and then back, and he was able to use the last of his blades, literally down to just a few inches, and cut a padlock on one of the manholes. He had tried several manholes and knew that he wanted to get back, but that now that he's cut out of the steam pipe, anybody that's working at the steam facility could see the open hole at this point, that they knew they had to go at this point. So that's when he returned back to his cell. They realized, Matt at that point realized, oh my gosh, he's out. He got out and he came back for me.
The other interesting part about it is that when Sweat was able to come through the other side of the steam pipe and access the outside from the manhole, he also told us it was in the early morning hours. So he felt there wasn't sufficient time to actually leave at that juncture. I mean, for Sweat, he could have left at that point. But he number
one. Yeah, that was my question. Why didn't he just leave?
Well, you know, two reasons. One, he didn't feel as if he had sufficient amount of time to truly make an escape because he's popping out, if you will,
3:30.
Right, literally on the other side of the wall. So, and he only had about an hour and a half, 2 hours before the final count. But secondly, he had this loyalty to Matt that he had promised and had given his word to Matt that they would escape together, and he went back to go get him.
And he hadn't brought, it's hard to imagine unless you were there, but the he hadn't brought any of the supplies. He had been spending months getting supplies from the commissary, which was surprising to me. That's where he was able to get power bars and pepperoni sticks and beef jerky and batteries and head, you know, lights. And he packed that into bags, and they had both recently gotten new boots, and they had prepped for this. So he had to go back and repack. But one of the interesting things about the perseverance of inmate Sweat was that he had been doing this for about 4 months and working a full-time job inside the facility that people don't understand. He was losing weight that was noticeable to many of the witnesses we spoke to.
He was trying to work out in order to have at least his muscle mass, if you will. He was eating straight protein at that point. He had a soft-sided guitar case that he was storing things in because that is what he was taking out of the facility. So to Jim's point, James Davis's point, is that he was had to go back to go get his supplies, and he felt that he couldn't be successful unless he had his supplies with him.
And that talks to his mindset and his discipline, doesn't it? He had a routine, and he would leave the cell, put a dummy in his bed, but always be back by 4 a.m. And there were certain ritualistic things that he would do, like cleaning his boots, to make sure that he had, you know, maximum chance of success. But he said he was in the best physical shape that he'd ever been in, and had lost, you know, you estimated around 30 pounds. But this was a very disciplined and well thought out, and he wasn't just going to do things by chance.
Yeah, right.
That's correct.
And on top of that, Laura, you mentioned his ability to sort of navigate through these tunnels and dark spaces. And some people just have an amazing ability in the area of directional orientation. I know my brother Tim does. He doesn't, when he lands in a different city, he knows exactly where he has to go. When he's in a cave or orienteering, he knows exactly where he has to go. Me, I would be lost in 3 seconds. But it's just some people have that internal gyroscope that allows them to know what direction they're facing. And he must be incredibly well gifted in that area.
He even knew, we spoke to that, and he even knew he was, his spatial awareness and his physical fitness and his mechanical mind and his perseverance. He was, you hate to give credit to an inmate and a cop killer, but he had mental fortitude, and he had a plan, and he stuck to it. And at one point, I'd asked him, what kept you motivated? You kept hitting literally brick walls. You kept hitting cement walls. You hit a steam pipe. You hit a 7-foot thick wall, and you persevered. What made you keep going? And he simply answered, he goes, I had a hole in the back of myself. They're eventually going to find it. So now, the ultimate motivator, right?
Exactly. And then juxtapose that with Matt, where Sweat was is extremely frustrated at times with Matt because he was the anti-Sweat, if you will. Mm-hmm. He would actually be drinking alcohol. He was very lackadaisical. He was very sloppy. He went out of his cell twice before the escape. He did not have the precision that Sweat exercised on putting the tape over the vent and then painting it over. And in fact, Sweat made him redo it one time. So there was a lot of frustration that Sweat had early on with Matt in terms of Matt not having that kind of precision and preciseness about what he was doing.
The Inspector General's report is 150 pages long. The most glaring examples of security lapses: 400 bed checks should have been done the 85 nights Sweat worked in the tunnels underneath the prison. The report says if just one had been conducted properly, the escape plot would have been uncovered.
Then what was it about the relationship that, I mean, I guess Matt was just the master manipulator and motivator. I mean, then what, you know, it's just interesting to me that Sweat, you know, he really could have done this by himself.
Yes and no.
Yes
and no.
Matt was the manipulative end. Now remember that Sweat and Matt had worked together in the tailor shop with Joyce Mitchell, but at one point Sweat is removed by the facility because there was rumors of him getting too close with Joyce Mitchell. And during that time, Matt was very good to Sweat. And in the facility, people don't understand that most inmates do not like the regular meals, which makes a lot of sense. So they use the commissary to order food. And during that time, they also make the most money in the tailor shops. So Matt basically supported Sweat when he was removed from that, from the tailor shops with him, supplied him with money and food, and so that his, I guess his lifestyle within there did not suffer. And Sweat said, I was very, you know, I felt like loyalty to him because he had helped me in a tough time. And Sweat had done the reverse too. When Matt was in trouble one time within the facility, he assisted him and sent him supplies.
I would also say that it was an interesting dynamic between the two of them. Matt had the ability to not only speak with the COs, but other mm-hmm. inmates in order to obtain things like radios and TV sets. Sweat was the electrician and the mechanical guy that would be on the catwalks connecting, it's unauthorized, but connecting those types of hot plates, radios, right. TV sets. So if you will, the Matt manipulation and the Sweat's expertise when and skill set when it came to those things, they were the perfect partnership.
And Sweat is a very quiet, reserved, and he let Matt do the most of the manipulation of Joyce Mitchell. It is Matt that was sending notes from Sweat back and forth, love notes. It was Matt that was constantly working that relationship in the tailor shop when he remained after Sweat was removed.
I want to paint pretty pictures for you. But I want to do them right on stretched canvas and make frames. But I need better tools.
What do you need?
And it was his master manipulation of everybody in that tailor shop, from the COs to the civilian leadership there, that proved the most influential and helpful. And he was the person that was receiving the hacksaw blades and other items. One of the things we learned while in there is that Joyce Mitchell had purchased unbelievably like 70 packets of pepper, and she brought in pepper, and she brought in rum, and she brought in cayenne pepper and salt, and she brought in work gloves, and she brought in boxing gloves and eyeglasses with lights on them. There was a constant back and forth with Matt to bring items out, to the point that Sweat said at one point, "You've got to stop, Matt. You've got to stop. We're going to get caught because you're being too reckless with what you're having her bring in," including an atlas. At one point, Matt was able to manipulate Joyce Mitchell, bringing in a color atlas of the United States, and he was given to him at his workstation, and he looked at it for 10 or 15 minutes, which is unimaginable because the security in that tailor shop room made no note of that at all.
Bear in mind, the genesis of all this is that Joyce Mitchell is in love with David Sweat. This is how it all begins. So the initial grooming, if you will, of bringing in the foodstuffs and the spices, that is what starts it. And then when Sweat gets moved from the tailor shop, Matt knows to follow up and does so in such a way, to Jim's point, where it's just over the top what Mitchell is now bringing in. But it really starts with the relationship between Sweat and Mitchell.
And that brings up a big point. And I'm sure that the very first thing that you guys thought when you heard about this, the fact that this was the first escape from Clinton in over 100 years, but wasn't it the only escape ever in history from the main prison, right?
Correct,
that's
yes.
That's right.
And so this, it had to go through your mind. It certainly went through my mind and the minds of other FBI agents and other law enforcement across the country, that they must have had some help. There must have been an accomplice. There must have been somebody on the inside. And you, as the Inspector General's office, I mean, isn't that your highest priority, to figure out what the hell happened here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And who was involved, and whether it was intentional or at that point just negligence and complacency in your duties and responsibilities, that's exactly that we were looking at. I mean, there were a lot of, you know, theories on how this occurred and who everybody thought was involved in it. It was really my job to figure out with specificity who actually was involved in it. And it really, you know, came down to Joyce Mitchell and corrections officers who were not at all doing their job, with significant long-standing breakdowns in basic security measures and functions, in addition to befriending a corrections officer that was doing, who was also an escort officer, and allowing that which Mitchell gave to Matt to be brought into the cell block, the on
block. So, but weren't all the corrections officers kind of, you know, reluctant to help you because everybody knew there was some kind of inside job kind of component to this, and who knew how far this was going to go?
Correct. So if I had to identify a major challenge in this investigation, it would be the fact that we had difficulty in having witnesses, albeit officers or civilians, testify to the truth of what occurred. In an unprecedented move, these witnesses had immunity granted by the prosecutor. So there was no reason other than tell the full and complete story of what it was that they knew. Incredibly, these witnesses testified that they had no recollection of events which occurred on the night of the escape. They couldn't remember people that they regularly worked with. They couldn't remember the events that occurred between in their working hours. That was the most challenging and frustrating part of this investigation, that we had a number of witnesses that just would not testify to the
truth.
And
so they did that deliberately then?
Correct.
But did they had immunity, but would that also keep their jobs intact?
Not necessarily.
Right. So there you have it.
A very insulated society up there with multiple generations of people working in the prisons. So you had sometimes two and three generations of people working in the same facilities.
The North Country in that particular area has a number of correctional facilities. So if you're not working at the Clinton Correctional Facility, there are other correctional facilities that people would work with. And to James Davis's point, these families, it's really, really legacy employment in terms of not only Clinton, but other correctional facilities in the area.
That's fascinating. Oh my gosh.
Wow. This is really an interesting conversation. I can't wait to continue it. We'll do so on our next episode. And till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.